I'm glad to see sisters in the union. It's about time. I've had excellent help in preparing these talks. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, sir.
Because when I first came in the trade union movement, you didn't have any microphones. You had to talk sometimes 1,000, 2,000 people without a microphone. Try that sometime. Now we have microphones, though we don't have one tonight. I received a great deal of assistance from Gene in our library. We have a library, you know, up on Franklin Street. And if you want to find out about the history of the union and go into the archives, you're perfectly willing to do it. And I also received help from Sid Roger. I don't know how many of you know anything about Sid Roger. He was a very well-known member of the union, historian, and I interviewed him shortly before his death, which was about a year ago, and he told me something that I had not really thought of before. He said that the 1934 strike was a revolution, and the 1948 strike, in which I played a very prominent role, was a counter-revolution. And now, my friends and brothers and sisters, we have reached a point where the employers are again trying to turn back time on the trade union movement. At the time of the 1934 strike, there was about 50% unemployment. 50% unemployment in the United States. It was a Great Depression, 50% unemployment. And little by little, the workers organized to fight back. And one of the things they did, which the trade union movement should begin to think about, is organizing the unorganized, organizing the unemployed, organizing the homeless. The trade union movement, the 1930s, did this. They built massive organizations of the unemployed. And when they went on strike, they organized the unemployed. It was not possible to get the organized unemployed down to break the strike. They were so well organized. Now, and they fought that side by side in order to build the trade union movement. Before 1934, the longshoremen in San Francisco belonged to the International ILA, the International Longshoremen's Association. It was a company union. Actually, it belonged to the FFL, but it was a company union. And the merchant seamen had no unions at all. They had unions, but they were not recognized in any way. And so they worked under terrible, terrible conditions. Before 1934, the average steady man, we had steady men then, made $30 to $40 a week. A casual, that was the rest of them, made $5 to $7 a week, and most of them were on relief. The hiring hall was the pool rooms, the saloons, and in front of the piers. It's called the Shape-Up. As any of you have read the Big Strike, you know that. The Shape-Up. People came in the mornings, congregated in front of the piers, and the boss would go out and say, you, 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 you. That's the way they picked the men that were going to work that day, except for the steady men, of course. The workers were treated like draft animals. They really were. One old-timer told me about a guy named Bull Hansen. He was a supercargo or something like that. No, he was a walking boss. He was so contemptuous of the men that sometimes he would get drunk and pee down in the hatch on top of the men working. That was a contempt that he showed for the men. In 1916, 1919, 1923, the seamen went on strike, and in 1919, the longshoremen went on strike, and these were all broken. But they learned certain conditions. And when the trade union movement started waking up in the 1930s, and Section 7A of the National Industrial Recovery Act was passed, which gave them ostensibly the right to organize and to bargain collectively. That was a stimulus for them to move forward. By 1934, 93% of the longshoremen were organized. They were in the ILA with no recognition whatsoever. Militants of all sorts, including the Communist Party, socialists, and so forth, were very active in this period. And they were the main organizers, as a matter of fact. The unions they had previously organized were called the Red Unions, but all of them got together. Now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you probably all heard about him, he set up a fact-finding board to try to stop the strike after the men had voted to strike. But they said no. The employers won't give us anything we asked for, and therefore we're going on strike. And 10,000 men in San Francisco went on strike on May 9th, 1934. By May 11th, the entire coast was on strike. And the seamen's unions joined, and the marine cooks and stewards, and they set up for the first time rank and file strike committees. They were elected right from the ranks. They bypassed the old company union, heads of the union, heads of the ILA, and just ignored them, completely ignored them. They set up mass picketing at all the piers, and all the unions, workers' organizations were contacted, and they put out a daily bulletin called the Waterfront Worker. It came out every day, and it kept everybody up to date of what was going on. And the strike was solid. The Teamsters supported it. For 2 months, they recruited people, especially some football players from University of California across the bay, and brought them in, but they really couldn't do any work because the sailors would not sail the ships, and very, very, very little could be done. After quite a number of months on strike, and all sorts of horrible things that were being done to the strikers, there was a battle called the Battle of Rincon Hill. It was at Pier 38. I don't think Pier 38 exists anymore, does it?
No.
I don't think so. Pier 38. There were 2,000 pickets with clubs and rocks and forth and so forth, and 700 police and thugs. And the battle raged all day long. And at the end of the afternoon, two men were killed right in front of the union headquarters, Howard Sperry and Nick Burdois. 322 strikers were arrested. And there was a man killed in L.A. too, named Dick Parker. There were 131 strikers, bystanders, and so forth, sent to the hospital. And the next day, after this, the Battle of Rincon Hill, and these men were killed, Governor Merriam sent in 2,000 National Guard. 2,000 National Guard pledged to open the port. They set up barbed wire on the waterfront, machine gun nests, armored car paroles, and so forth. And by this time, there were around 250 ships tied up on the coast, but they didn't move. Cargo came off the piers to some of the warehouses, but it stopped there because the Teamsters refused to move it. They supported the strike. There were several great big incidents up and down the coast, too. There's a book called Waterfront Workers on the Waterfront by Bruce Nelson. I don't know if any of you ever seen it or read it. But on page 129, he tells you about what happened in Seattle and in Portland. He said, "From the beginning of the walkout, the strikers displayed awesome courage and militancy. In the first few days, there were violent outbursts up and down the coast, as employers hired large numbers of strikebreakers and tried to maintain business as usual behind a protective shield of police. In Oakland, according to the newspaper reports, 400 strikers stormed the gates of the municipal pier, quote, drove police before them and staged a hand-to-hand battle with the strikebreakers. In Portland, quote, a mob of 400 striking longshoremen threw one policeman into the water and severely beat several others in an attack on a ship housing scabs. The most dramatic confrontation occurred in Seattle, where timid and conservative ILA leadership stood by as employers put strikebreakers to work on every pier. In response, on May 12, 1934, a flying squad of 600 Tacoma longshoremen, along with several hundred strikers from Everett and all the militant men we could find in Seattle, stormed the docks. The army of 2,000 men battered down the pier doors, swept police aside, and halted work on 11 ships where strikebreakers had been handling cargo. That was the kind of battle that it was. It was a bitter battle and a bloody battle. Now, the ILA strike received great support from all the unions, from the unemployed. They set up strike kitchens where money and food poured in, and everybody had something to eat. You could bring down your family and so forth, and the union guaranteed the people, if the rent wasn't paid, that it would be paid after the strike was over. The nurses and doctors organized to come down in squads and to help out. They had defense guards to help man the picket lines. After Rincon Hill and the two men were killed, right down here at Stewart and Mission Street, that's where the headquarters was at the time, the general strike was really inevitable. The workers realized that they had to stop the violence against them, and they had to maintain the strike as far as not allowing any ships to move. And the workers, other than those down on the waterfront, said to themselves, and this is a quote from the big strike, if a big, well-organized militant strike like this is smashed by police and National Guard, how can organized labor survive? End quote. And that's true. And now we're reaching the point in our history where strikes are being broken again. And we have to remember this. What they did in that strike was block all the railroads. The railroad workers stood behind them. They blocked them. And food during the general strike, food and oil and so forth came into San Francisco only by union permit, by the strike committee's permit. So the general strike. Only 19 restaurants were allowed to be open. Only 19 restaurants were allowed to be open. And the hotels were and they were not in the hotels either. They had pickets on the hotels. Now what had happened here? Labor withdrew their power to work. Sometimes you brothers and sisters don't realize that without workers, society could not operate. I mean, you can do without CEOs, and you can do without a lot of those millionaires up there. I mean, if you ought to send them down here to work on the waterfront, because they play no useful role that I can see. But anyway, when the workers withdrew their power from the waterfront, the whole situation was useless without them. And the question was raised, who shall run things? And actually, for the 3 days of the general strike, the workers ran San Francisco. They ran San Francisco. Now, the employers fought back in every way they could. They started a Red Scare, saying that everybody, all the leaders of the strike, including Harry Bridges, were communists, and they refused to deal with communists. And they set out, well, you have to call them thugs, groups of thugs, and most of them turned out to be policemen dressed in workers' clothes to raid the trade unions and the various halls where workers congregated. And on the streets, they arrested 350 communists. Now, who did they arrest? My wife knows this story, so she starts laughing. They arrested people that were not very well dressed, had a little beard maybe, looked a little bit shabby and so forth, because this was a picture of a communist that they had in their mind. And most of these people actually, in the whole, all these arrests of 350, they actually arrested only 3 members of the Communist Party. All the rest were complete, not involved. Though they wrecked a few halls and so forth. Now, the AFL-CIO was very frightened by this. And the federal government was frightened, too, with this display of workers' power. And they decided that concessions had to be made in order to stop it. And so, the federal government entered, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, federal government entered, and they gave the union the hiring hall, which we still have in part, the 6-hour day with overtime after 6 hours, and 95 cents an hour. By the way, when I first came down, they were working $1.10 an hour. And they conceded load limits. The load limit was 2,100 pounds. And they agreed to steady gangs for a period of 3 years, until 1937. Now, why did the ILA get this settlement? Not just a general strike, but there was a movement throughout the workers in all of the United States, a militant movement, and they felt that they had to make some concessions. But actually, the hiring hall, the 6-hour day, the load limits and all, had already been established before the ruling on October of 1934 after the strike was over. They had all been established by the workers on the job. They had established this. Now, it wasn't until there wasn't another strike. By the way, the Stevens unions were not recognized until 1937. That's a different story. Now, most important was the collaboration that you were talking about of the trade unions. All the unions stuck together. They all stuck together. And that's what won the strike. And they set up a maritime federation, which included all of the unions except the SUP. And later on, the SUP, I mean the, not the SUP, the Sailors Union Pacific. Yeah, Sailors Union Pacific, SUP, Sailors Union Pacific. Now, there wasn't another strike until 1937, and that wasn't a very important one. It was to maintain what had been gained when employers were trying to take it back. The next strike was after the World War II in 1946, which was a strike to regain all the losses that had been suffered during World War II. Because during World War II, they had a wage freeze, and they so-called had a price freeze, too. But the price freeze never worked, except the wage freeze did. And the cost of living went up during the period of the World War II about 52%. But wages did not go up. And so the 1946 strike was to bring the wages back up. But in 1947, as a matter of fact, the Taft-Hartley bill was passed. Now we're coming to the second big strike, 1948. In 1947, they passed the Taft-Hartley bill. Still, it was a sort of a quiet year, and June 15th, the contract was renewed for 1 year to June 15th, 1948. June 15th, 1947, 1948. But anti-labor legislation legislation was pending in the Congress, and in late June 1947 came Taft-Hartley. Now, Taft-Hartley put wind in employers' sails. They decided that using the Taft-Hartley, and if Thomas Dewey were elected, he was the Republican running for president against Truman, as I remember, that they could roll back the Union and take back the gains that had been won in 1934, 36, 37, and 46. They wanted a completely employer-controlled hiring hall. They wanted preferred gangs. They wanted steady men, and they wanted the election of the dispatcher by. They wanted to do away with the election of the hiring hall dispatchers by the union, and they refused to deal with what they called the ILWU communist leaders, led by Harry Bridges and others. The union said, no way, the people we have, and we want more. We want a wage increase. And the strike was set for June 15th, 1948, and at the last moment, President Truman imposed an 80-day cooling off period. But nothing cooled off. The employers were so happy to get rid of that cooling off period. They preferred a strike. During the cooling off period, I was one of these stewards. I was a steward in Gang 100. And we held a watch and sent out a load every 5 minutes or 10 minutes. We cut production down by 50%. And the employers didn't like it, but the union had control, and that's what we did. After 80 days, we were back on strike again, and nothing had cooled off. Now, what was the Taft-Hartley Act? We have some bills now that are not quite like the Taft-Hartley Act, but they have the same effect. They prohibited the closed shop. Couldn't have a closed shop. And the ILWU-controlled hiring hall was considered a closed shop. They required that every union officer submit an affidavit annually to the National Labor Relations Board swearing that he or she was not a member or affiliated with the Communist Party or any organization that teaches the overthrow of the United States government by illegal means. A very ambiguous law. And almost all of the trade unions opposed the Taft-Hartley, including all the maritime unions that had taken strike votes. And I almost forgot point three of Taft-Hartley was falsification of an affidavit submitted by the union official meant a $10,000 fine or 10 years in federal prison or both. Now, how did the union handle this question? They took a secret ballot whether or not to accept the employer's last offer. And they also took a secret ballot on the question of Taft-Hartley. The one on Taft-Hartley is the most interesting one. The question was, do you or do you not want your officers to sign a non-communist affidavit? The vote was 10-0, no. Then the union offered to elect a rank and file strike committee with no officials, but the employers said no. Then a few days before this new strike deadline of September 1st, the Waterfront Employers Association submitted their last offer. One, no union-controlled hiring hall, no rotational hiring, preferred gangs, steady men, back to 1934. 26,695 ILWU West Coast longshoremen were eligible to vote. The yes vote was zero. The no vote was zero. Ballots challenged, zero. Total ballots cast, zero. Well, that was the turning point. The membership understood that red baiting, like racism, are used to poison workers' minds and destroy unity. They understood that, and they voted no, 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 no. And the zero meant no. And so the 48 strike began again on September 1st, and it was solid. with all the unions backing it. Again, a strike committee was set up. Committees were set up to make sure that no one got evicted from their homes. They guaranteed no evictions, and the union will see that the rent is paid when the strike is over. And the strike committee, of which I was a member at that time, both 46, 48, met every single day at 10 o'clock in the morning. The only day they didn't meet was Sunday. But they met every single day, and there were about 100 members on the strike committee here, and we met. We didn't have this building then. We were down on the waterfront. Now, the 48 strike, when it began again, drew all the lessons of the 1934 strike. The strike committee set up a joint strike committee with all the other unions. All of the unions on the waterfront became part of this. And they met at least once a week and sometimes more often. And they put out leaflets. They put out a strike committee bulletin, sometimes every day and sometimes every two or three days to keep the membership informed. They had a welfare committee, which took up all these questions of evictions and so forth. And for their strike committee, strike kitchen, they demanded and got one half of all the perishable cargo that was unloaded off the ships that were tied up. And this went directly to the strike kitchen. And we sent out, I was part of one of it at one time, we sent out trucks into all over the area, up to Petaluma to get eggs and chickens and so forth, and down south to get vegetables and so forth. And all this came back into the strike kitchen and everybody was fed. Now, the strike kitchen was not only open to strikers, but it was also open to families on base of need. Everybody who was on strike was given meal tickets if they asked for them. And discipline, every single member of the union had to picket, unless they were sick. And you'd be surprised, there were a few after the strike was over that all of a sudden got well. But they were disciplined. And we had a veterans patrol. There were a lot of veterans from World War II. They organized, they wore their caps and so on and so forth, and they patrolled the picket lines along with other pickets. And we had a night patrol. Now, I have to tell you a few things about the night patrol. I was in charge of the night patrol. And the reason why I was in charge of the night patrol, because they had brought in a few scabs at Fort Mason. And not very many, but they had some out there. And we wanted to find out about them and get them out of there. Now, the first day they tried it, we put 1,000 pickets on Fort Mason. And there were quite a few battles, and some of us were hurt. In fact, I got my neck smashed a little bit. But we pretty much stopped them going through the gates into Fort Mason. 1,000 pickets, you know, are a pretty formidable force to be faced by a few scabs that want to go in there and get a job. Now, the night patrol was very interesting, but let me tell you a story about the encounter we had with the police. Now, the police in those days were not as bad as the police now, at least not the ordinary policemen on the patrol. They didn't have tax squads then. And many of the policemen had formerly been members of unions, and we encountered one of them at Fort Mason. After the first day, the captain who was in charge of the police there, he called us over and he said, who's in charge here? I said, well, we have three picket captains. I'm one of them. He said, well, I want to talk to you. And we went to his car, and we got into his car, and he said, look, I want to tell you who I am. He said, I'm a former member of the Boilermakers Union. And he pulled out his retired Boilermakers card. He said, I'm really with you guys, but you're making a lot of trouble for me. My jurisdiction ends two blocks away. I don't care what happens after two blocks away. So we said, okay. So we went back and we told the man, no violence on the picket line. We're going to break you up into three-man gangs, and the scab goes through and won't stop, and he comes out, you follow him, okay? So that's what we did. And there were fights all over town. And one guy named Big Bill Hawkins, big guy. I don't know if any of you knew him, or you might have a son or a daughter here. Big Bill Hawkins encountered one of these scabs up in the Fillmore district, and they had a little altercation. And this guy, unfortunately, was armed with a knife, and he cut a hole in Big Bill Hawkins' side here. But he lived. He didn't die. He went to hospital, and he got sewed up and so forth. And when he came back, he went around showing everybody that scar. Look here. Look at that scar. Like, you know, like President Johnson, like President Johnson did one day. But anyway, we pretty much stopped it. And then we turned out that one of the guys in the union had a niece who worked in Fort Mason. And she worked in the office. So she turned over the names and addresses of anybody who went through that picket line to work. And some of them came in by boat. And so we would, the night squads, that's the role of the night squads would go out and find these people and go in and knock on the door, use any excuse, telegram, anything, and push right in, two or three or four guys, and say, look, don't go to work tomorrow. If you go to work tomorrow, it's going to be hard for you. So just don't go to work tomorrow, right? You understand? Don't go to work tomorrow. You know it was 95% effective. It was 95% effective. Most of those guys just decided it isn't worth it, and they didn't go to work. Right in the middle of this, the Army set up a special group, a special stevedoring company to handle Army cargo at the Army base. And they agreed to all the demands that the union was making, except the wage increase, and said that they would abide by wage increase if one was won in the strike. And so we were able to, that helped us a lot, because we were able to get a couple days a week, and that, plus the strike commission, strike kitchen, was able to see us through. Now, finally, after about 3 months, and all the union hating and red baiting, and Pink Hall Fossey, he was the head of the Waterfront Employers Association, and his bunch were pushed aside, and negotiations began. Because they realized by now, the employers realized that they weren't going to win this strike. They had been defeated, and they realized it. And they came to the table, and they agreed to a new contract. They agreed to shorten the work day from 10 hours to 9 hours. It had been 6 hours straight time and 4 hours overtime. Now it was 6 hours straight time and 3 hours overtime, but a wage increase was sufficient, so there was even more than we gained before. They agreed to no steady men. No steady men. They agreed to a 4-hour guarantee. If you showed up for the job, you got 4 hours. They agreed to load limits, the same as before, 2,100 pounds. They agreed to continue the low man out system. That is, the person with the smallest number of hours, the smallest earnings, would be the first one to go out in the hiring hall. And all the unions on the strike won. And they all went back to work, and it was a great, great victory. And it decided on something that is now being pretty much lost by the trade union movement. The pace of work and the quality of earnings. Those are the two things that the union in my day had. They controlled the pace of work, and they controlled the hiring, and they controlled the equality of earnings. Everybody at the end of the year ended up pretty much the same insofar as wages is concerned, except for a few walking bosses and supercargos and special, some, a few special workers like gear men and so forth who were steady workers. The other thing that was important about this strike is that nobody went back to work until all of the unions had settled. All of the unions had settled. And that's in 1934, they had gone back. This set off this strike, and also a strike in Minneapolis, the Teamster strike, and in Toledo, the auto worker strike, three big strikes that were won at this time, set off a whole period of strikes. And that's when the trade union movement in the United States made its biggest gains in the 1930 period. It was in the 1940-50 period. Now, I could tell a lot of interesting stories about things that happened, but I want to tell you a little bit about World War II. World War II, the Union supported the war. But during World War II, on the San Francisco water, on the waterfront, up and down the coast, actually, there were many strikes. There were strikes over speed up, there were strikes over load limit, and pretty much, though the load limits were broken down a little bit during World War II, that is prior to the 1948 strike, they were pretty much maintained. But the 48 strike was a strike to push them backwards, and it did not succeed. Now, on the West Coast, from 1930 to 1948, there were a total of 1,400 strikes. Now, most of them were quickies, you know, over conditions, over load limits, over hiring, or something like that. But they were strikes, and they were strikes, like I said, during World War II also. Now, as far as conclusions is concerned, it is my opinion that we are entering into a period now where the employers are trying again to take back the things that have been won by the workers down through these many years. They've passed laws for the last 10, 15 years now where if the workers go on strike, they're replaced by scabs. Even if the strike is over, the scabs can still stay there. They pass laws like that. They pass compulsory arbitration laws where you don't decide. Some board up above decides what you do and what you don't do and what you can accept and what you cannot accept. And right now in the Midwest, there are two strikes going on. What's the names of them, Ruth?
In Decatur, Illinois.
There are two strikes going on there. Been going on for a year. What they did, they raised their work day from 8 hours to 12 hours a day, which is a pretty considerable increase. And with no increase in wages, the employers, the union turned it down and went on strike, and they brought in scabs, and scabs are still working there. There was a big demonstration there, I think it was just this last week. Last week, 10,000 workers came from all over the country, including the top leaders of the FLCIO, to demonstrate there in favor of the Decatur strike. But that's only one instance. There are many more taking place right now. The trade union movement is at a low ebb, and that is why I belong to Labor Party advocates, and Ruth belongs to Labor Party advocates. Actually, she's been on many picket lines and demonstrations as I have down through these many years. And we feel that workers can no longer depend just on their economic power. They have to depend on politics. They have to have their own political organization which speaks in their name, will defend them, will elect workers to take place in Congress, in the legislature, and in the state offices and so forth. Because actually, workers are more important than bosses. You ever stop to think about that? Workers are more important than bosses because workers produce the wealth. When workers, if you didn't have any workers, you wouldn't have anything. You could do without a lot of the bosses, especially those making like $3 million a year. CEOs, why do they make $3 million a year? The reason they make $3 million a year is because they downsize, they eliminate workers, they increase hours, they hire more part-time workers that they don't have to pay insurance to and welfare and hospital and all that sort of thing. And they outsource. That's another term. Outsource, you heard that term? How many of you heard that term? Outsourcing. It means they take your jobs and they send them overseas. They send them to some place where they don't have to pay such high wages. And there go your jobs. They would like very much to transfer a great deal of the longshore work down to Mexico. And actually, they're building ports right there now on the West Coast and on the East Coast too, to try to transfer shipping as much as they can away from where the unions are to where the unions are not. They have broken the longshore unions of Mexico. They broke them how? With police. The government went in with police and government agents and smashed the union, took all their records, destroyed them, and their wages now, like you said, were $8. They were $8 an hour,
yeah.
And now they're $1 an hour. Is that what's coming for us? I don't think so. I think what's coming for us is we're going to have to take a hand now, and we're going to have to decide our own destiny. You can no longer depend upon those who represent the employers, the Republicans and Democrats. You have to build a Labor Party in this country. That's what I think, and I think that you should begin thinking about this too. And thank you very much. I will ask you. I will answer questions, but I want to give you a little information here about the recent. By the way, there was a 1960. There was a contract called the Mechanization, Modernization, and Mechanization Program contract. I voted against it because I thought the union gave up too much for what they got. And then in 1966. There was another thing added to the contract, 9.43. You probably heard of 9.43. It's a steady man. See, we never used to have any steady men. It's a steady man part of the contract where employers can hire a person and they can stay on the job. They don't have to go back to the hall. Anyway, From 1948 to 1972, the longshore workforce dropped from 27,000 to 13,500. 13,500. And in that same period of time, now this is according to an authoritative source on the waterfront by Federal Reserve Bank of California. This is what they say. Between the M&M contract, modernization and mechanization contract in 1960 and 1970, PMA members had saved probably over $900 million. But only 62 million of that amount had been shared with the longshoremen in the form of improved retirement and pay guarantee benefits. That is what has happened. That is what has happened with these contracts. And I'm convinced that sooner or later they're going to have to be turned around. There's this book, which can be obtained. There's Waterfront Workers, Workers on the Waterfront, that is also for sale. I see it's recommended in the dispatcher, in your dispatcher. And by all means, you should read The Big Strike. Are there any questions?
Okay, just before we get into questions, I want to touch on one thing, which is that what the struggles that were taking place in the past are going to start happening again now as your B members and casuals coming in to become B members. And this Thursday, I guess most of you know, how many of you have read the latest Stewart's Bulletin, the blue one?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know that APL is starting to put their ship under a foreign flag. And the reason that the ship owners are doing that is to get away from unions and to get away from paying taxes and to get away from the Coast Guard regulations. And the government over the last 20 years has been given the green light to the ship owners to just go ahead and do that. But now it's becoming even more of a danger to us because, as Asher said, there's the striker replacement law. Taft-Hartley, which I don't think Asher touched on, but a key aspect of the Taft-Hartley law bans solidarity strikes. And where our union was strongest is when the union stuck together and struck together. It's illegal in the United States to strike against another employer that's not your employer. However, that's where our strength is. In 1984, Local 10 conducted a strike against a ship that came in from South Africa because the unions there were the blacks in South Africa under apartheid were trying to form unions. The government said that's illegal, and as they went on strike, they were shot down by the army, and Local 10 voted to shut down the next ship that came in from South Africa. Well, actually, that was illegal. So what the union did is had community people go put up a picket line. And then we had a health and safety clause in our PCLCD contract. That is, if you feel threatened or whatever, you don't have to go to work. So technically, it wasn't a strike. But everybody knew that we weren't. It wasn't that we were afraid to cross the picket line. You know, we actually helped initiate the picket line. And so that's how we try to get around or circumvent the anti-labor laws in this country. There's all kinds of ways. They're going to use a similar kind of method Thursday. The Sailors Union and the Marine Firemen and the other unions that are being kicked off the ships are going to, I understand, have a mass picket out there, but it's going to be, they're not actually going to have a what's called a bona fide picket line. That is, a strike over wages, hours, and working conditions. It's going to be a strike that's protesting their taking away their jobs. And so what we're going to be doing is honoring it on the basis of health and safety. Now, from what Asher said, where we had our strength was when we stuck together in the 34 strike, 36, 46, and 48. And it wasn't always perfect, but the essence of it was, and the core of the whole thing, is that the unions, by and large, didn't go back to work until the other union, everyone was satisfied. We haven't had those kind of strikes in a long time, and I'm not saying that's what's going to happen on Thursday. I'd love to see that happen on Thursday. I'd like to see one union in this country stand up to the employers and say, we've had enough, and we don't care what the law is. We're going to go to the mat on this one. But that I'm afraid that's not what's going to happen on Thursday. It's going to be health and safety, and I'm not sure how long it's going to go on. And unfortunately, hundreds of seamen are going to be losing their jobs. So there's a strike, that a stand that has to be made, and I hope it is made, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
Is this just a two-hour protest?
Excuse me?
Is this just a two-hour protest?
Well, it's going to start as a protest. And where it goes from there, we don't really know yet. So the ship's coming in at 1700. That's 5 o'clock Thursday. They're going to start picketing over there about 3 or 4 o'clock. A lot of the signs are going to say this patriotic stuff about American president lines is selling out the country. Well, the point is that they need to go on the ship and organize those seamen that are on the ships, regardless of what nationality they are, Filipino or whatever country they're from. They need to be in the union. They want to be in the union. But the laws in this country prohibit the unions from going on and organizing it. It's actually against the law. This, of all the industrialized countries in the world, the United States has the most anti-labor laws. And that's why in Europe the unions are much stronger. They're able to have solidarity strikes. In Poland, when there was strikes starting to take place that were political against the government about 10 years ago, the newspapers in this country were all calling for solidarity strikes in Poland, but not in this country. When the miners struck in this country, you know, they didn't want the railroad workers or Teamsters to solidarize with those strikes. They didn't want solidarity strikes. It's all right in other countries, but not here. So on Thursday, we're going to see firsthand what's happening. And I think a lot of the drama that Asher portrayed in our history, I'm afraid a lot of that fire isn't going to be there. There'll be a lot of flag waving, but when it comes, push comes to shove, I don't know how long this is going to be sustained. Like one of the brothers here said, it's going to be a protest. It's not really going to be an actual bona fide picket line.
They're not going to give little jobs to that company, are they? That night? If we come and get a job Thursday,
are
they going to give out them jobs?
The jobs will be dispatched because what Asher hinted at, it is no longer a union-controlled hiring hall. It's jointly controlled with the PMA. When he was referring to the Waterfront Employers Association, that was the predecessor to the PMA. So this hall now is jointly controlled between the union and the PMA, and there's an agreement to dispatch the job. So people will get dispatched. Maybe some of you in this room will get dispatched to go to APL. Stewards and BAs and our union officials will be out there. So all I suggest is, use common sense.
The seamen going to have a picket line?
Seamen, all the maritime unions are going to be out there picketing. There'll be probably about 1,000 people. And if that's not health and safety, I don't know what is.
That's health and safety.
So the question is, how long are they going to be able to sustain it? I hope they win it, but you don't win a strike in one day or 2 days.
No way.
Unless you shut down the whole city.
So they're going to have pickets against the Jiffle, both gates, right? The pickets on each side.
Yes. And also I hear the railroad workers may be lending some support to, you know, the railroad that runs across there. So.
It was announced at the San Francisco Labor Council last night
Just one last point. You know, the significance of this picket line on Thursday is that the PMA, just like any other organization, has its dominant forces within that organization. The dominant force in the PMA is the ship owners, and the dominant ship owner is APL. They call the shots in the PMA, and so how APL goes is how the rest of the PMA is going to go. So we're not just supporting somebody else's struggle. It's our struggle, too. And that's how we have to look at it. Because if they knock off the sailors and the marine firemen and the captains and the mates,
they will knock you off.
There you go, brother. Walt, you've been around the block a few times. And anyway, I want to open up the deck for questions now. Does anyone have a question for Asher on the history of the ILWU?
Any questions?
Well, while you're thinking of a question, I want to, for Asher's contributions to Local 10 and giving, he's given a few classes now, I want to give him a steward's pin from Local 10 in appreciation for...
By the way, that was one of the beefs on the waterfront when the foreign ships used to come in here and they would try to use the seamen to load and unload the ship. And we said, no way, that's our work. And then there was a beef a little bit later on with the SUP, where the SUP wanted to extend the right that they had to work the coastwise ships, you know, steam scooters and so forth. They wanted to extend it to the other ships, and we said, no way, that's our work. But actually, the only way you win a strike in the long run is by shutting it down. There is a method now called the corporate campaign. Have any of you ever heard of that? The corporate campaign, where you have picket lines. You go to the corporation and you try to embarrass them. Or you go and you pass out leaflets downtown or something like that, and so forth. These corporate campaigns have been tried several times now, including the Midwest in the strike that I told you about, and in the P9 strike, which I don't know if you ever heard about that. I can't go into it now. But the corporate campaign is deadly. It doesn't win anything. The only way you win if you stop the job. That's the only way we ever won anything. Or if they know that you have the power to stop the job. And actually, the ILWU still has that. It still has it. It doesn't have it like it used to have it. You don't have the control on the job like you used to have it now. Not when you have some longshoreman making $100,000 a year, and others, what do you make,
$40,000?
What? What is the average wage now, $40,000? What? Well, anyway, you see that an inequality has developed in the union, which I don't like. When I came into the waterfront, everybody made just about the same money. And if you were low on the totem pole, as far as your hours are concerned, you went out first. Well, there were cheats, all right. But you know what we did? You caught them, you gave them 30 days off. And if they did it again, 90 days off. They did it again, out. Out. So you did have equality. And I hope someday that equality will be restored. I don't like what is happening in the union. It does not the union that I belong to and have belonged to since 1941. But it's still one of the best unions in the world. This is one of the best unions in the world. And employers know it. They know it. When they write here, they tell you, well, they've lost a lot, but they still have more control over the job than most unions do have. And that is true. That is true. Very few unions have control on the job that we have. We're losing a lot of it, and we'll have to fight to keep it. But this is a good union, and I think I was a lucky person to be a member of it for most of my working life.
Are you going to set up picket gangs for ETL?
Let me just tell you how it's being organized. All of the maritime unions except the ILWU is going to be setting up the picket lines. And we're the ones that work the ships, that move the cargo. If the cargo doesn't move, then the company doesn't make money. And so what they decided to do was set up a picket line that the longshoremen will honor on health and safety. That's the last I heard of it. You know, it's gone back and forth a few times. At first, it was going to be a bona fide picket line. And they were going to go all the way with it, no matter what the fines were, because what happens usually in a strike, when you go on strike, what usually happens in this country